Okay, good morning, everybody. Oh, I forgot my microphone. I knew there was something funny going on. All right, so this is Bible 241. I'll probably say it again. Once we get started here. Okay, test, 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 volume, volume test, Bio 241. Okay, Bio 241, today is May 9th. Yeah, am I right or am I just dreaming? I can't believe it's May 9th. Anyway, I think it is May 9th, and we're going to finish up blood, heart, and circulation today, and this is on the test. Okay, well, I've quieted down a little bit, but not too much. All right, then we're going to move into cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. Okay, so cardiac cycle, that's where we were last time. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Don't forget, your last exam is on Thursday, May 30th. Good thing I read that. Otherwise, gee whiz, you'd all get a zero on that last test if I showed up on Wednesday. Okay, so let's get the projectors going like this. Maybe turn down some lights, like that. All right, so we left off around here. We talked about the cardiac cycle, mostly because, okay, ladies, hold on, there might be some people sort of listening right behind you. Okay. Cardiac cycle, remember that the heart is a pump, but it's not like an electric pump that you have, which continuously pumps a fluid through some kind of system, okay? This pump is what we call a reciprocating pump, which means sometimes it's pumping and sometimes it's not. And the reason why sometimes it's not, because it has to relax and dilate so that it can fill up with blood so that when it contracts again, it has some blood to pump. All right, so there are two phases, and you know the two phases, systole and diastole. Diastole is relaxation phase, systole is contraction. And the heart contracts just as a unit. But first the atria contract, because those are the superior ventricles by the base of the heart, and they help load a little volume into the ventricles. So the atria pump blood into the ventricles, and then when the ventricles are full, they contract about 100 milliseconds later. And I guess I could ask you, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Yeah, four. How many valves does the heart have? Some of you maybe looked that up. Since Tuesday, that's really good. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two. And I want you to know that because how many circulations are there in your body? There are two, right. And they match up to the sides of the heart. So the two are your systemic circulation, and the second one is pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation is relatively short. Therefore, it doesn't have much resistance, so the heart doesn't have to develop a lot of pressure. The pressure in a pulmonary trunk or artery is about 25 over 10. And of course, that's systolic over diastolic. And for the systemic circulation, it's a lot higher because it's a lot longer circuit. There's much more resistance in that circuit. So the blood pressure has to skyrocket in order to make blood flow the same, right? So both the right and left ventricle have to pump the same amount of blood. Otherwise, blood is going to pool someplace, right? If one side of the heart is pumping more than the other, then fluid is going to back up behind that pump that's not pumping very well. And it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally you're just going to explode in a big pool of blood. Who's listening? A couple people. All right, that won't exactly happen, but almost it will happen. All right, so the pressure, systemic pressure is 120 over 80, much higher than the pulmonary pressure. Here are some good definitions. I don't think we got to this slide. Oh, yeah, I think we did. Now it's coming back to me. End-diastolic volume, okay, that's the volume of a ventricle at the end of diastole. So is that a big volume or a little volume? Because what happens during diastole? Yeah, the heart has to fill with blood so that when it goes into systole, it has something to push against, to pump. So end-diastolic volume is the large volume that we're going to measure. And, of course, we measure it in milliliters. And systolic volume, and what can you tell me about systole? Systole is? when the heart contracts, and when the heart contracts right at the end of contraction, that's the smallest volume inside of a ventricle. Right? And again, we measure that in milliliters. And the stroke volume is just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it does pump or every time it does beat. And that's just the difference between end-diastolic volume and end-systolic volume. And please remember, it's not a negative number, right? Okay, so you just got to subtract one from the other. So we're going to look at a Wigger's diagram in just a little bit. Here are some things that you should pay attention to when we get there. And that is, since the heart has valves, sometimes all the valves in the heart are closed at the same time. Right, so, for instance, if this room, if all the doors were locked at the same time, then the number of people in here can't change, right, because nobody can enter or leave. The same thing for blood. When all the valves to the heart are closed, blood can't enter or leave, but maybe the heart is still contracting, and when it's contracting, okay, the pressure is building, but the volume is not changing, right, if all the valves are closed. On the other hand, if all the valves are still closed and the heart is relaxing, all right, the volume stays the same, but the pressure decreases. So one we call isovolumetric contraction, and the other is isovolumetric relaxation. We're going to find that on the Wigger's diagram. And when does that happen? When all the valves to the heart are closed. Okay, so let's go right to this Wigger's diagram. The one that I like was in your lab book. But this is pretty good. This Wigger's diagram is just a plot versus time, right? So the horizontal axis is time. The vertical axis has a number of parameters. For instance, here is the electrical activity of the heart. And what do we call that? That's your electrocardiogram, right? We measure that on the surface of your body. And then this tracing here is just some noise that the heart makes, right, in the normal heart. And these noises come from closing valves, right? If a valve is damaged, it might make a noise when it opens, but in a normal heart, valves make noise when they close. All right, so here is sound, here's electrical activity. This next axis over here, this is the volume of probably the left ventricle, right? So let's think left ventricle, and so volume 130, 90, and 50. I don't see it on my slide, but hopefully it shows you what it's in milliliters. Right, you should know the dimensions of these things because a milliliter is what? A volume. All right, and then the last one is pressure versus time. And we have a number of different traces right here because some of these traces show you pressure of a ventricle. All right, so here's ventricular pressure. Here is pressure of an artery like the aorta. And then down over here is atrial pressure. So it shows us three different kinds of pressures. And that's going to be very instructive to know when these valves open or close, right? And the really nice thing about this graph is that all of these physiologic parameters are lined up exactly. They're justified in time, right? So this right here is the same time as this right here. I mean, the beginning of this noise is right at this part of the electrocardiogram, which is right at this part of the volume of the left ventricle, and same thing right here. It's at the exact same time for all these pressure curves. So these things are all justified nicely together. Okay, so here we see the ECG. I guess we're going to start right here. ECG, yeah. Well, I tell you what, the one clue that I use, here we start, so we have this blue curve. Okay, starts at zero, okay, and it goes up to 120. So the right ventricle would even get close to that, right? The right ventricle maximally would go up to maybe 25. So that would probably be one really good way. But the curves should look pretty much the same. The overall shape, the overall profile will look pretty much the same. So it really doesn't matter too much if we're looking at least for this discussion, whether we're looking at the left or right ventricle. But if we look at these numbers, for sure, we're going to recognize it to be the left ventricle. All right, so let's look at the electrocardiogram first. This is electrical activity on the heart. We see a number of waves. Here's the P wave, right? That's the primavera wave. That's the first wave that represents depolarization of the atria. And depolarization is the signal for what? That's the start of excitation contraction coupling, right? The heart can't contract unless it gets a signal, so this is the signal for the atria to contract. It's not really when the atria contract, but it's the signal for contraction. Contraction is going to happen at a little bit different time after the P wave. And then we have the QRS complex, and we know that the QRS complex is due to electrical activity in both the atria and the ventricles. So we started with atria, so let's finish up the atria first. All right, so after depolarization, what happens to any kind of muscle and even a nerve?
Excited.
Okay, yeah, after depolarization, what's the second phase of electrical activity? Electrical activity in the cell. So the cell goes back to normal resting membrane potential, that is? Repolarization, right? Okay, so P wave is depolarization of the atria. QRS partly is due to repolarization of the atria, but it's a small bump right here. During that same time, that's when the signal for contraction enters the ventricles, which is, they're much, much bigger, a lot more tissue, and the QRS also represents depolarization of the ventricles, right? So the QRS complex is due to two things, atrial repolarization and ventricular depolarization. And remember that depolarization is what? A signal for contraction. The contraction of the ventricles will happen after depolarization. Contraction can't happen before depolarization. Yep, right at this time, in the QRS complex. Yep, because here's the P wave, and the P wave represents depolarization of the atria only, not the ventricles. Okay, so at this time over here, then the atria repolarize, and it just so happens this is the time where that electrical signal gets through the fibrous myocardium into the ventricles and causes the QRS complex. And we can't really separate the two. I don't think anybody's figured out a good way to separate the two. And the reason why you can't see repolarization of the atria is because there's just so very little tissue right there. It's not a very big signal compared to the QRS complex. Right? So I guess one way to think about that is if you were to go outside right now and the sun is out, sun is shining, let's pretend it is. I don't think it's overcast. All right? And if you look up in the sky, it's going to look blue, but do you see any stars? You might see the sun. Don't look at the sun, of course. But when you look at the sky, do you see any stars? Everybody's shaking their head. No, that's a good thing. But are there stars there? And the answer is yes. You just can't see them because why? The sun is so bright. So the same thing happens here. You can't see atrial repolarization because the signal from ventricular depolarization is just way too great. Sign and sheet is probably coming around really soon. Thank you. Okay. All right, and then after ventricular depolarization, what happens? Here we see some more electrical activity following ventricular depolarization, and that is what? That's called the T wave, and that is ventricular repolarization, so the heart can go back to resting membrane potential.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, is it within the QRS wave?
I'm in the QRS, yes. Atria repolarized at that time. Yeah. So here's depolarization of the atria. Okay. Here's repolarization of the ventricle. So the atria will have to go through an event like this, but it's going to be what? A much smaller wave than what you see here. And if you take that much smaller wave and put it over here in the QRS complex, you can't see it. But it is happening during that period of time. Okay. So what you can see is what the repolarization wave is not nearly as high as the depolarization wave. So here's depolarization, so repolarization is just going to be a little tiny signal from the atria. All right, so remember, electrocardiogram is the signal for contraction. So let's look at some pressure curves. I think I want to look at some pressure curves first. And remember, how does a fluid flow? This could be a gas, for instance, in the room, or it could be a liquid that's in your body. And another good way to think about it is a chemical, maybe in solution. How does it move around? How can it move around? Yeah, it goes from high concentration to low, or high pressure to low pressure, right? So fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so let's look at, I think, this blue curve first. And we see that the pressure in the left ventricle is zero, and it bumps up a little bit right in this region. Okay, and that's due to contraction of the atria. Right, so the pressure increases in the ventricle just very slightly because of contraction of the atria. So you can see that the physiologic effect of atrial contraction is pretty small. That looks like maybe about 5 millimeters of mercury, and we said the peak was 120, so that's less than 5%, that's maybe 3%, right, of the volume comes from atrial contraction, not very much. All right, so here is the QRS complex again, and what did we say that was? Signal for contraction of the ventricles, right? All right, so that depolarizes the ventricles, and then they start to contract. So what happens to the pressure inside the ventricles when it contracts? Think of a water balloon that you have in your hand and you squeeze down on it. What happens to the pressure? Does it increase or decrease? It increases, right? So the pressure is going to increase. All right, so let's now layer on the pressure in the atria. We see that the pressure increases after the P wave because the P wave is the signal for contraction, so the atria start to contract, right? And then the QRS complex happens, and then the ventricles start to contract, and the pressure in the ventricles shoots way up right at this point in time. And we see the curves going over each other. They're crossing over. So at this point in time, when there's high pressure in the ventricle, it's going to want to go back into an atrium. Whenever the pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atrium, it's going to want to go backwards into the atrium. But we don't want that to happen, right? Because that eventually will kill the heart if it does happen. All right, so to prevent it from happening, what does happen? A valve closes. And at that point in time, the atrioventricular valve closes. Since we're talking about the left side of the heart, which one would that be? That would be the bicuspid or mitral valve, right? Because you try before you buy, if you memorize your atrioventricular valves. Okay, so here is an AV valve closed. And the left ventricle still starts to contract, but at this point in time, the AV valve is closed, but also the semilunar valve is closed. All the valves to the heart is closed. So what's happening to the volume of the heart? Here we look at volume. The volume stays the same between these two lines right here, but the pressure goes up. So we call this isovolumetric contraction because all valves are closed. But as soon as the pressure inside of the left ventricle is greater than the pressure in the aorta, then blood from the ventricle is going to flow into the aorta. That is allowed because what happens? The aortic semilunar valve opens. Right, and when the semilunar aortic valve opens, now the volume of the ventricle can change. Right, if all of a sudden I open up that door, unlock that door, you guys can leave the room. Right, it's just like blood leaving the heart. When that semilunar valve opens, blood can leave the heart. So blood is leaving the heart during this whole period of time because there's higher pressure in the ventricle compared to the aorta, and blood's going to flow into the aorta. All right, so if we look at the volume curve, right, during diastole, the volume increases because blood is flowing into the left ventricle. When it starts to contract, all the valves are closed. Isovolumetric contraction takes place. When the semilunar valve opens right at this junction, then the volume of the heart starts to decrease because the heart is pumping blood into the aorta. Okay. Then, and these curves are a little bit off, okay, we would really want to move this over to here, but when the pressure inside the left ventricle goes below the pressure of the aorta, right, blood in the aorta will want to go back into a ventricle. But can it do that? Can blood go from the aorta back into a left ventricle in a normal heart? So this blue curve, you should probably draw over right to here. Bring it right to this point right here. So what happens when the pressure in the aorta, which is where I have the cursor, is greater than the pressure in the left ventricle? Blood is going to want to flow from high to low. Blood will want to flow from the aorta into the ventricle. It can't because there's a semilunar valve there. And when blood starts to flow backwards, it closes. So at this point in time, the aortic semilunar valve closes. All right, and what did we do over here? We closed the AV valve, and we didn't say it opened up. at any particular time. So between this line and this line, all the valves to the heart are closed. Right? Blood can neither enter nor leave. So what happens to the volume of the heart? It stays the same. So this period right here is isovolumetric because the volume of the left ventricle isn't changing. But what is happening during this time? Is the heart contracting or relaxing? It's relaxing. So this is isovolumetric relaxation. All right. And now remember, here we have a little curve of that atrial pressure. And we see that the ventricular pressure drops below the atrial pressure. So now blood will want to go from an atrium into a ventricle. So what has to happen at this point in time, which will allow that to happen? The atrial ventricular valve opens up, and then blood flows from the atrium into the ventricle, which is what we see on this volume curve right here. All right, so now the heart starts to fill up with blood, and then we see a little bump right here because of atrial contraction. Okay, and then we have another period of isovolumetric contraction, and then this is the ejection phase where the heart is pumping blood out of the heart. And this just goes over and over and over again. One thing I forgot to mention right here, this is the period of what? Isovolumetric, what's happening? Relaxation. Yeah, isovolumetric relaxation. So this is very similar to an exam figure that I put in Blackboard. And it has just a number of little labels that you have to put on it. I modified it compared to how it was in your lab book. But hold it up if anybody has a copy of it. Ah, that's it right there. Okay, just like this. This is the figure. This is the exam figure. I like this one over here. Okay, so we've got what? Pressure versus time. We've got volume versus time. Electrical activity versus time. And also sounds that the heart makes. All right, so here we see that the AV valve closes, atrioventricular valve, because the pressure in the ventricle is higher than the atria. And when it closes, guess what happens? It makes a sound, right? So at the beginning of systole, the AV valve closes and makes this heart sound. We call that the first heart sound. And then the heart goes through ejection phase, and the pressure inside the ventricle drops below the aorta, and at this point in time, the aortic semilunar valve closes, and that makes the second heart sound. So I really only want you to know about these first two heart sounds. Okay. So here's the second one. Yeah, so the second one happens at the beginning of diastole. The first one happens at the beginning of systole. So you should really figure out which valves are closing during those times. And when you see that, then I think you'll understand something more about these periods of isovolumetric contraction and relaxation. All right, just remember, these isovolumetric periods happen when all valves to the heart are closed, when that happens. And you can tell when that is, right, by this pressure curve. And you can confirm your understanding of that by looking at the change in volume, because here is a volume curve of the left ventricle. All right, so this is in milliliters. This right here is in millimeters. So pressure is in millimeters of mercury. Those are the units for these graphs right here. So this is a really good graph to look at to make sure that you understand what the valves are doing in the heart, what the ventricles are doing, what the atria are doing. Because with this diagram, we can see activity in the atria, activity in the ventricles, and contraction activity, right, or contraction. Does contraction of the atria and ventricles happen at the same time? Okay, when you look at this graph, here's the time axis. Right, so here is contraction of the atria. Here is contraction of the ventricles. So the atria contract first, right, compared to contraction of the ventricle. So both atria contract followed by contraction of the ventricles. And that matches up with the electrical excitation of that tissue. Right, so here we have depolarization of the atria before depolarization of the ventricles. Both ventricles contract together, both atria contract together, and they're separated only with a short period of time. And we're going to look and see how that happens. Okay, who looked at this? Maybe between now and Tuesday and have some questions. Do you have any questions on this Wiggler's diagram? Okay, I'm sure there's some pretty good stuff online that you can look at too. Okay, so heart sounds, we talked about the heart sounds. Heart sounds, number one and number two, are due to what in general? Closing of valves, that's right. And the first heart sound happens when the ventricles start to contract and what valve has to slam closed? That's the AV valve, yeah. And since we're looking at the left side of the heart, that would be the bicuspid valve. Right, and when the pressure inside the ventricle gets higher than the aorta, then the semilunar valve opens up and the heart ejects blood into the aorta, and then the heart starts to relax, the pressure drops below the aortic pressure, and blood doesn't flow backward very much from the aorta into the left ventricle because what happens? The semilunar valve closes, aortic semilunar valve, that produces the second heart sound. Okay, I'm going to go back to this one right here. Ah, here I see, okay, decreasing pressure during diastole in the aorta, increasing pressure during systole, right? So pressure is going to increase about to what, 120 millimeters of mercury in a normal individual. It's going to drop and then go back up. What is this thing due to? Okay, remember, in order for these valves to close, they don't have muscles, that doesn't require ATP, it requires blood actually to flow backwards a little bit to get caught in the valve leaflets, and then they will inflate. And when that happens, there's this transient decrease in pressure within the aorta. This is just showing you that the aortic valve really is closing, and some of that pressure energy is used to close that particular valve. We call this the dicrotic notch. Okay, that's probably in your textbook. I don't see it on this illustration right here. Dicrotic notch. And that belongs there. That should be there. It shows the closing of what? The closing of the aortic valve, which is that dicrotic notch right there. Okay, heart murmurs. Sometimes we listen to somebody's heart because we want to hear when the hearts are opening and closing, and if there are malformations in the valves or even in the septa, between the ventricles and atria, then the heart is going to make all kinds of spurious sounds, right? And those abnormal sounds we call murmurs, right? So some of them can be caused by defective heart valves. They can be congenital in origin, or they can be developmental as a result of certain kinds of infection, for instance, like rheumatic fever. Sometimes when your body develops an immune response to bacteria, it's going to produce antibodies, and every once in a while, those antibodies will cross-react with the person's own tissue. And in this particular case, it's going to be valve tissue. So the person's own body is damaging those valve leaflets. And that's typically due to a streptococcus, a systemic streptococcus infection. All right, so that certainly does happen. This is just an autoimmune disease that could happen very easily because, you know, there's a vaccine for dental caries. Because you have dental caries because of that bacteria that live underneath various plaques that you have on your teeth. And they secrete an acid, and it's that acid that erodes the tooth enamel away, and that's what gives you a cavity. All right, so there's a way that we can inoculate people so that they don't get any of those dental caries, right, if we give them a vaccine against that particular type of bacteria. So then that person will develop antibodies to kill those bacteria, and they'll never have a dental carie or a cavity ever after that. But something they found, unfortunately, was that when, at least in animal models, it never got to human stage of development. In animal models, monkeys develop antibodies against their own heart. So for sure, those monkeys wouldn't get cavities, but they wouldn't have what either? They wouldn't have a heart. So the choice would be obvious, right? You would never want to sacrifice your heart just to protect your teeth. Okay, so that just shows some of the, here are the bacteria that cause dental caries, and we can certainly vaccinate against these, but when we do, those antibodies then cross-react with a person's own myocardial tissue. And, of course, that kills them. Other kinds of heart murmurs. What were these right here? Damage. Yeah, when there's damage to a valve, it might make a swishing sound. Okay. And, for instance, maybe a valve doesn't open completely. If it doesn't open completely because of calcifications or other kinds of thickening of a valve, then it's going to make kind of a swooshing sound as well. And another way that a valve can not work, okay, is if it leaks. And when it's leaky, then it's going to make a squeaking sound. And all these problems with a valve, we call that valve to be incompetent after that. Right, because they don't close properly, then that might damage the papillary muscles. That's going to overwork the heart and probably cause heart failure if it's not treated. Right, so in most cases, these valves, well, probably almost in every case, a valve has to be repaired or replaced so that the heart can work normally. Other kind of murmurs that we have. I mentioned septal defects. So here we have a nice illustration of the heart, and here is the interventricular septum. And sometimes there's a congenital abnormality of the ventricular septum that puts a hole right here. So there is a patent foramen between the left ventricle and right ventricle. And when the ventricles contract, remember they contract together, which way is the blood going to go? The hint is it's going to go from high pressure to low pressure, which means what? It's going to go from left ventricle to right ventricle in every case, right? So here we see some blood from the left ventricle squirting into the right ventricle, and that's going to make a squirting sound as well. All right, so that should never happen, even in the fetus. But in the fetus, you know that there should be a patent passageway, a patent foramen between the right atrium and the left atrium to bypass circulation to the lungs. That would be normal in the fetus because the fetus is not using their lungs. But as soon as somebody is born, that foramen should close over. And does anybody know what it's called when it closes over? Then it's called the fossa ovalis, right? It's a foramen ovalis when you're a fetus, and then when you're born, then it becomes a fossa. Fossa is just a depression, but not a passageway. All right, but if it doesn't close over, then somebody does have a hole in the interatrial septum, and that causes problems as well. That eventually probably will damage and kill the heart. But sometimes that defect is so slight that somebody doesn't even notice it until they're 40 years old. So sometimes it can exist, condition can exist for a long period of time. So there might be somebody in here that has a patent foramen ovale. That's what PFO stands for. All right, but sometimes it's very obvious, and then that newborn baby, you can tell, is not oxygenating their blood properly because of a patent foramen ovale. And what color will they be? Instead of being pink in certain parts of their body, right, they're going to be blue. That's right. And what do we call that condition? Cyanosis, right? Okay. So that would be one clue that we'll have to image these hearts to find out if the heart is built properly and to look at patterns of flow within the heart. All right, so we said that the heart contracts as a unit. And again, how does it contract? What contracts first? The whole heart doesn't exactly contract at the exact same time. The atria contract first, followed by the ventricles. Okay, so myocardial cells are short. Remember, they're short compared to skeletal muscle fibers, and they're also branched, and they have intercalated discs behind between the cells so that when a cell contracts, they don't rip apart because then there would be a hole in the heart. So there are junctions between the cells that glue them together, but there are also special channels between cells that we call gap junctions. And I'm sure we looked at these already. Gap junctions is a special kind of electrical synapse that allows sodium to enter a neighboring cell, causing depolarization, which is excitatory on that neighboring cell. And that's why the whole heart contracts together. And we like to think of it as a functional syncytium. And a syncytium is really just one cell For instance, a muscle fiber, skeletal muscle fiber, is a syncytium, and a syncytium just means that there were a number of cells during development that fused together to make one big cell. So there are progenitor cells that made skeletal muscles, and they all fused together to make this really long fiber. And how could you tell that that really long skeletal muscle fiber originally was a number of cells, maybe 100 or 1,000? What's one way you could tell? Because it is multinucleated, right? It has tens, maybe hundreds of nuclei in that particular cell, and all of those nuclei came from one individual cell that fused together, and then after fusion, okay, what do we call that cell? We call it a syncytium. The heart doesn't fuse together quite like that, but because of the gap junctions, it works like it is a single cell, right? That's why we call it a syncytium. So action potentials originating in any cell of the heart are transmitted to all others by these gap junctions. Okay, here is something that probably you knew. The atria and the ventricles are separated electrically from each other because there's a layer of non-conductive electrical tissue between them called the fibrous skeleton. Right, so in order to conduct these action potentials, you need to be, what, a neuron we looked at, or a muscle tissue. And if there is connective tissue, it can't transmit action potentials. There are no connective tissues that transmit action potentials. So that layer is a separation, an electrical separation between the atria and ventricles. And that's one reason why the atria contract before the ventricles. So here is, I'm sure, an exam figure. And here we see a part of the heart that, actually the whole heart is autorhythmic. All of these cells will spontaneously depolarize. And it just so happens that this sinoatrial node right here has the fastest rate of depolarization, of auto-depolarization. And what is what do you recognize depolarization to be? What kind of signal is it? It's always going to be excitatory, right? So the sinoatrial node depolarizes at a very rapid rate compared to all other cells that normally depolarize. Right. And since it depolarizes first, then this is the signal for contraction, because that action potential from the sinoatrial node will flow through all atria, right? Because all these atrial cells are connected together, but that action potential can't get into a ventricle because of the fibrous skeleton that's between the atria and ventricles. All right, well, that sounds bad. That sounds like the ventricles can't contract. But there are some modified muscle cells in the atria that we call the atrioventricular node. They depolarize, and it takes them a long time to depolarize, unlike the other cells of the atria. All right, so an action potential eventually starts in the atrioventricular node, and then there are some more modified myocardial cells, right, that make up the atrioventricular bundle, or bundle of His, and that's what carries the signal from the atria into the ventricles right through the fibrous myocardium. So that's how electrical signals get into the ventricles. And then there are some bundle branches, there's right and left bundle branches, and again, these aren't neurons, even though they're colored yellow, these are just modified myocardial cells. And then this action potential moves very rapidly down through the septum to the apex of the heart. And then there are branches that we call Purkinje fibers, which then allow the spread of action potentials through all of the contractile myocardial cells. And here is, right, some more bundle branches that stimulate Purkinje fibers up the free wall of the ventricles. So what this shows you is that an action potential moves very rapidly through the fibrous skeleton down to the apex, and the apex actually contracts a little bit sooner compared to the more basal regions of the ventricles, because it takes just a little while for those action potentials to move back up the walls, the free walls of the ventricles. Okay, so when we look at electrical activity of nodal tissue, like the SA node, AV node, right, the atrioventricular bundle, and even these Purkinje fibers, an action potential is going to look a little bit different compared to an action potential that is produced by these myocardial cells. And you'll be able to recognize what the difference is. You'll be able to say, oh, that's a nodal cell just by looking at its action potential. Or a contractile cell from a nodal cell. And of course, it's going to look a lot different than an action potential from a neuron. But it's going to have some similar characteristics. All right, so here is a plot of voltage versus time for a nodal cell. Right, so these don't contract, but these carry electrical signals from one cell to another, from one place of the heart to another. And we can see that there really is no resting membrane potential. These cells really don't sit still at any particular resting membrane potential, because as soon as they reach this most hyperpolarized region, what happens to the membrane potential of this particular nodal cell? It starts to depolarize immediately. We call that a pacemaker potential, right? And these are due to special channels in the membrane that we call HCN channels. And HCN channels allow sodium to leak into the cell, right? And when that happens, that causes depolarization. And then when that cell reaches threshold, something else happens. When it reaches threshold, then some calcium voltage-gated channels open up. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. Calcium then rushes into the cell. And when it does, what does it produce? When a positive charge enters the cell, that depolarizes the cell, and that's another excitatory event. Okay, so, and then these nodal cells are going to repolarize through the similar kind of mechanism that you're used to, and that is what? Opening of slope voltage-gated potassium channels, and the cell repolarizes, goes down again to about minus 60, and then because of those HCN channels, what happens? The cell automatically starts to depolarize again. When it reaches threshold, then it produces another action potential. All right, so this region right here is what we call a pacemaker potential, and it's due to these HCN channels. And because these HCN channels are in myocardial cells, they are autorhythmic, right? They will just repeat this cycle over and over and over again. All right, so this is what an action potential from a nodal myocardial cell looks like. There can be ectopic pacemakers. What does ectopic mean? It means at a location other than the normal location. Right, so usually where is the normal location at? Right here, in the sinoatrial node. But if there is damage to the heart that might disturb the pacemaker potential in all of the other myocardial cells, some of those cells might actually reach threshold first before the sinoatrial node, and then that location of the heart, it could be in some part of the atria, it could be in a ventricle, then will act as a pacemaker controlling the rate of contraction of the heart. We call that an ectopic pacemaker, right? Because all tissues in the heart are spontaneously active. But under normal conditions, they depolarize. The pacemaker potentials depolarize at a slower rate compared to the sinoatrial node. Right, and so when the sinoatrial node produces an action potential, then all the cells undergo that action potential, and these other sites of the heart can't be the pacemaker because the sinoatrial node is controlling when contraction takes place. Okay, myocardial. Okay, so we looked at those nodal cells that had maybe that almost resting membrane potential of minus 60 millivolts. Now let's look at the contractile cells of the myocardium. They're muscle cells, but now these are actually the ones that shorten and contract and produce pressure. All right, they have a resting membrane potential of minus 90. That's what you're familiar with. Right, they depolarize the threshold by action potentials originating from where? The pacemaker of the heart, whether it's an ectopic pacemaker or a normal pacemaker, and the normal pacemaker is what? The sinoatrial node. And this is what the action potential looks like from a contractile cell in the myocardium. So here is a plot of voltage versus time once again. And we can see that when an action potential from maybe a Purkinje fiber stimulates a contractile cell, it causes this depolarization, right? Because of what are those channels between cells called? If there are intercalated discs, but what's the special feature inside an intercalated disc? Gap junctions, right? So sodium enters via a gap junction and it raises or depolarizes the cell to threshold, right? And so this upstroke right here is due to voltage-gated channels that open up very rapidly. And so depolarization is due to sodium rushing in. All right, but now here's something strange. This is kind of what we're familiar with, but don't forget it has to reach threshold first. Look at repolarization. It doesn't immediately repolarize and then hyperpolarize and go back to resting membrane potential. There is a plateau phase within the contractile cells of the myocardium. And this plateau phase is extremely important, and it's due to opening of voltage-gated calcium channels. And again, where do we have calcium at a high concentration? On the outside of the cell. So when those calcium channels open up for the contractile muscle cells, calcium enters the cell, and when a positive charge enters the cell, what does that produce? Depolarization, right? That causes depolarization. So this plateau is just a sustained depolarization due to these calcium channels that open up and they're slow. Right, so they stay open and they allow for this plateau phase, and then they slowly start to close, but then these potassium channels are still open, and then repolarization and even hyperpolarization takes over. All right, so this is a really good way to tell from an action potential whether you're looking at a contractile cell because it has a plateau phase, or what, a nodal cell. Another difference is, in a contractile cell, we don't have a pacemaker potential, right? We don't have, these typically are not autorhythmic, or at least as fast as a typical sinoatrial node is. Okay. Ooh, where did we go? Okay. So you got to know something about that plateau phase. The other interesting thing is when we looked at neurons, okay, did action potentials summate? Can action potentials ever summate? Okay, here's an action potential from a contractile cell. Action potentials don't summate. Because why? Because of a refractory period, right? The absolute refractory period. And because of this plateau phase, there is an extended absolute refractory period. So what is really nice about that is that it prevents the heart from going into tetany. So the heart, like other muscles, skeletal muscles in your body where you might get a muscle cramp or that muscle contracts, right, and you'll do anything to relax that muscle, the heart can't do that because of this long refractory period. Once the heart contracts, it's always going to relax as a result of that. And that's really good because you wouldn't want your heart to seize in systole. You want it to relax so that blood can flow back into it. All right, so that's the job of this plateau phase, or why these cells have evolved with this funny-looking action potential. Okay, this slide right here. I think we talked about everything on this slide already. The Purkinje fibers, right and left bundle branches. All right, one thing I think I do want to say is that those action potentials from the nodal fibers, right, they speed down through the bundle branches to the apex, which means that the apex contracts a little bit before the free wall of the ventricles. All right, now, how does blood get out of the ventricles? Is it from an apical region or from a basal region? Where are the arteries connected up to the right ventricle and left ventricle? They're up by the base of the heart, right? So if the basal regions of the ventricle started to contract first, they would pump some blood into the arteries, but they would also pump some blood where? Down toward the apex of the heart, and it has no place to go. All right, so what's really nice about the heart as a pump is that the apical regions contract first, forcing blood where? Up to the base of the heart, right into the arteries, and then more basal regions contract, and then even more basal regions contract, so the heart squeezes blood into the arteries very nicely as a result of that. Okay, so here are the velocities of those action potentials through the nodal components of the heart, so you can see how that changes. Excitation contraction coupling is very similar to skeletal muscle, right? But a big difference is that most of the calcium comes from outside the cell, but some from sarcoplasmic reticulum. But nonetheless, when calcium enters a myocardial contractile cell, calcium binds to troponin. That moves tropomyosin out of the way. That allows for cross-bridge cycling and then sliding of myofilaments over each other. Right? And repolarization then occurs as calcium is pumped out of the cell and back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so excitation-contraction coupling is pretty much the same as in skeletal muscle because they both have sarcomeres. Now, here is a plot of membrane potential. So we have voltage versus time. And we also have another curve, but we don't have an axis drawn for it. And so what this represents, and I guess it looks red to me, might be brown. So this one right here, this is contraction of the ventricles. This is tension developed. So somebody put a tension meter on the heart, and when the heart starts to pull, this is the trace that you get. Okay, so this is a good figure for a couple reasons. Because does the electrical activity and the contractile activity of the heart occur at exactly the same time? You can see that. Does the electrical activity, like the QRS complex, right, or this action potential here, occur exactly when the heart contracts? Because here's that time scale. Do they happen at exactly the same time? No. What happens first? The electrical activity happens first, followed by contraction, right? Okay, and we kind of know the reason why that is, because it takes a while for calcium to enter the cell and cross-bridge cycling to begin. But nonetheless, when the myocardial cell is in this plateau phase, then we have that absolute refractory period. And remember, action potentials can't summate over here. So that means then that a heart muscle cell can't go into contraction again until after repolarization of that cell, which then means that that heart cell has to relax before it can contract again, which means then that heart muscle can't go into tetany, which is really a good thing. You wouldn't want myocardial tissue to go into tetany because then the heart would never fill with blood and it could never pump blood again after that. Okay, so that's what that shows. Well, you probably are sort of interested, what does an action potential from a contractile cell look like compared to the voltage that we measure on the surface of somebody's body? Okay, so here we have a plot of an ECG, which is voltage versus time, on the surface of somebody's body, plotted against voltage versus time from a single contractile myocardial cell. All right, so, and they're justified in time. So the QRS complex begins when? Right when these cells depolarize, and then there's a constant voltage, and repolarization takes place during what period of the electrocardiogram? During the T wave. Oh, what did we say the T wave was? We said the QRS is due to depolarization of the ventricles, and the T wave is due to repolarization of the ventricles. And so that's how that action potential from a contractile cell fits very nicely, okay, into this electrocardiogram. All right, so this electrocardiogram is not an action potential. It's the sum of what? Millions of action potentials from all those cells on the heart. Okay, that electrical activity makes it to the surface because of all of the ions that we have in our body that can carry that current. Right, so QRS is due to depolarization of the ventricles, the T wave is due to repolarization of the ventricles. And if we compare that with that previous slide, when does contraction take place? Okay, compared to depolarization. All right, compared to the QRS complex. It happens after the QRS complex. So since they happen in time just that way, since electrical activity happens before the contractile activity, that is evidence that this electrical activity is what? Causing this contraction. Certainly it is the signal. Now, every time you see curves like that or see a sequence like that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the first thing that's happening causes the second thing, right? But in this particular case, that is really good evidence. Okay, could anybody think of maybe something that's cyclic in nature where there's no cause between the first event and second event? Okay, I could think of one. And that is, how about if you set your alarm clock to buzz every morning, maybe a half hour before sunrise? Okay, so you have to reset it every day because the sun changes its cycle a little bit. So you wake up a half hour before the sun comes up every day, and would that be absolute good evidence that you're waking up, or the signal on that alarm clock is causing the sun to rise every day? Okay. The answer would be no. The sun would rise up in the sky whether your alarm clock signaled it or not, or if you woke up or not, right, the sun would still rise. So causation can't be proven by looking at these curves and see and then recognizing which one happens first. Okay, but it's pretty good evidence for this ECG because we know something about excitation-contraction coupling. All right, so we got these distinct waves. We talked about this already. Remember, the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. What are they? They are electrical events that happen inside the heart that then signal contraction to occur. All right, then you got to rely on excitation, contraction, understanding to know why that happens. All right, so what do we call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Oh, I forgot. It's electrocardiogram, all right? And what do we call the piece of paper that comes out? That's the graph, the electrocardiogram, right? Okay. All right, so which event occurs first in the heart, mechanical contraction or electrical events? Yeah, we looked at that in a number of different cases, from the Wiggers diagram on. So here we have probably a pretty cool plot which shows how the myocardial cells, I don't see the nodal cells doing much in this particular diagram, but at least the contractile cells, when they depolarize and probably when they repolarize. But I can't see repolarization. So this yellow right here represents, what, a wave of depolarization starting at the SA node, right? And that depolarization moves through both atria very rapidly because these are electrical signals, right? And then here they flow, it has flown over both atria. So what are the atria going to do now? They're going to start to contract, right? And remember, those action potentials from the atrium can't just automatically flow into the ventricles because of the fibrous myocardium. Can't transmit action potentials. It is just connective tissue. But you have the AV node, right, and the AV bundle that can take signals into the ventricle, into the bundle branches, right, and it zips down to the apex. So that's what we see over here. Action potentials zip down to the apex and travel up the free walls of the myocardium. And when that happens, that's the signal for a contraction of the ventricle, starting with what? The apical regions and then followed by the basal regions. And then after that, you have, what, repolarization taking place in the ventricular cells. All right, so how many colors do you see here? What color is this? Yellow. And what color is this? Red. Do you see any other colors? No. Okay. You see green? Ah, where's green? Here? Over here. Top one. Green. You see green in there? In the atria. Both sides of the atria, and they're yellow here. What is this green down here?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, so green is what? Repolarization, I guess. And then this right here, that's the red color, huh? I don't know what that represents. But maybe if I could see it, I could describe what those colors are. It's probably pretty nifty. Okay, but I can't see it. All right, we correlated the ECG with heart sounds already because we looked at that Wiggers diagram. And so you know that both atrial ventricular valves close together, both semilunar valves close together, and we talked about why that is. Right, and that's because pressure determines which way blood is going to flow, and when it flows retrograde, there's a valve in the heart that prevents that from happening. Structure of blood vessels, this is really nice. This is nice familiar territory, right? Because you know all that stuff from anatomy already. So I'm not going to describe the layers of arteries and veins to you, except maybe I'll help you recall some things. What is a big difference between an artery, a vein, and a capillary? Contrast a capillary with all other kinds of vessels. A capillary only has one layer, and that layer is an epithelium. It's simple squamous, and it's lining that blood vessel, so we call it an endothelium. And because it's very, very thin, it allows for exchange. So things can only enter and leave the cardiovascular system or the vascular system through a capillary. It can't leave through an artery or a vein, even a venule or an arteriole, because the walls of those vessels are way too thick. And indeed, there are muscle layers in there. Okay, so here is a nice functional diagram of the vascular system. So we have blood coming away from the heart, and what do we call a vessel taking blood away from the heart? That's an artery. It flows into the small artery here that we call an arteriole, and then sometimes to a capillary if this circular smooth muscle right here relaxes. And this is what we call a precapillary sphincter. It can contract and close off blood to this capillary, or it can dilate. And when it opens up, then blood is going to flow through this capillary system. Exchange will take place, and then that blood will flow back into the venous system. So control of this precapillary sphincter is under intrinsic control. It's due to metabolism that's happening in this tissue. Okay. We call that local control. Local control is even a better way of talking about it. So for instance, let's just say, we don't see these cells right here, but let's just say this is a skeletal muscle cell. And when that skeletal muscle cell is at rest, like right now, let's just think of your biceps brachii, it's at rest. Right? So what's happening to its metabolism? Is glycolysis going crazy, making ATP when that cell is at rest? No, everything is pretty stationary, right? So glycolysis really isn't producing much ATP. Probably no lactic acid at all is being produced. And that muscle is using very little ATP up, so there's probably very little ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And the acidity of that muscle is not changing. The pH is not changing, right? And since lactic acid is not being produced, it's not being released from the cell, since ADP isn't being produced, it's not being released from the cell, and the pH is not changing either. So under those conditions, right, this precapillary sphincter is going to remain closed. But as soon as that muscle starts to exercise, what happens to lactic acid? It's going to start to build up, and remember, lactic acid can leave the cell. And when that happens, then lactic acid is going to cause relaxation of this sphincter, and when it does, right, blood can start to flow through that capillary, right, and it will take that lactic acid away, it will take that, and ADP probably works the same way. When it builds up because of muscle contraction, then it's going to affect this sphincter to relax as well. It's going to increase blood flow. So blood flow is increased when metabolism of the tissue around that capillary bed is activated. We call that local control. And when that tissue is quiet, then the precapillary sphincter closes. All right, so that matches perfusion to activity of this particular tissue, and we call that local control. So the local conditions control these precapillary sphincters, not the autonomic nervous system. Because we're going to look at that again in the lungs. Okay, so remember, fluid flows from high pressure to low pressure. The biggest pressure drop in the vascular system happens at arterioles. That's when the biggest change occurs between the diameter of arteries and the diameter of all the arterioles in your body. That's where the biggest pressure drop is. Not so much in capillaries and hardly any pressure drop in a vein because by the time blood gets into a vein, it's almost at zero pressure. Okay. So which of these vessels right here has the highest pressure in them? That's always a good trick question. Because we always talk about how special these capillaries are. And indeed, they're special. Right? So a lot of times, somebody might say, well, the lowest pressure is in a capillary. But if the lowest pressure is in a capillary, what's going to happen to blood in this vein? It's going to flow back into a capillary, right? It's not going to flow back into the heart. So there's more pressure in capillaries than veins. So blood will flow out of capillaries into veins and then back to the heart. And we're going to talk about that. Okay, precapillary sphincters of this arteriole controlled by local control. All right, you should remember that there are three different kinds of capillaries based on how leaky they are. What's the leakiest kind? Discontinuous. What are the least leaky? Continuous, and in between are fenestrated. Right, and that all depends on the intracellular clefts between the cells and whether there are fenestrations or pores within the cell. Right, but in any case, none of these passageways should allow cells to leave, only fluid. Right, the fenestrations and the clefts are not big enough, or the gaps are not big enough for red blood cells to get through, only fluid. But some tricky white blood cells probably can, because some white blood cells can move around by what kind of process? Does anybody know why some white blood cells are shapeshifters? We call that diapedesis, right? So some of those spaces between capillaries is big enough for some white blood cells actually to crawl out of the vascular system. Okay, veins. What can we think about veins? Think about veins once again. Okay, they have many layers, and they have an endothelium, just like capillaries and just like arteries, but there's something even special about a vein compared to an artery. It has all the same layers, but it has something, another structure that's special. Yep. And it has valves. Veins have valves, right? And capillaries don't have valves, and arteries certainly don't have valves, and that's because there's very little pressure in a vein. So how does blood get back to the heart if a vein has very little pressure? There's no force to force it back to the heart. Okay. So let's talk about veins. Veins are very compliant. That means they expand readily when there's a small change in pressure. And probably a good way to think about that is think about a tire on your car, right, and a balloon. And if you blow into the balloon, what's going to happen to the balloon? It's going to expand, it's going to get bigger. Now use that same force that you can generate with your lungs and try to blow up your car tire. Is it going to move? No, the tire is not going to expand, right? The pressure increases a little bit, but not enough to make a change in volume of the tire. So which one is more compliant, the balloon or your car tire? The balloon is much more compliant. That's what we mean. So veins are more like balloons than your car tires. Very small changes in pressure cause big changes in volume of veins. Not so for arteries. Not so for capillaries. All right, so they contain very low pressure, maybe about 2 millimeters of mercury. So how does that venous blood get back? Well, here we have a segment of vein, and we can see some valves. Right here, and I can see some valves. And in this particular case, this valve is open. And this valve is closed. In this case, both valves are closed. And this vein happens to go between two skeletal muscles. And when these skeletal muscles contract, right, they bulge, they get bigger, they get shorter, but they also bulge, get bigger in diameter, and they're going to squeeze this part of the vein. And when they squeeze this part of the vein, there's now high pressure in this vein compared to the other segments that are proximal and distal to it. And what does the fluid want to go? What does the fluid want to do? Move from high pressure to low pressure. So if there's high pressure here, it's going to want to move into the low pressure chambers above and below it. Okay, but can it move down into this proximal division of a vein? It can't because this valve is going to close. But when there's high pressure here, it's going to open up this valve because of its anatomy, and blood is going to flow through this open valve to this next segment of a vein. back toward the heart. So blood in a normal vein can't go back to the periphery. When muscles contract, it always gets squished back to the heart. We call that the skeletal muscle pump. So that's one important way that blood returns to the heart via the skeletal muscle pump. And that's why veins have to have valves. If somebody has dilated veins, okay, then these valve leaflets and veins can't touch each other. So when a skeletal muscle contracts, right, then blood is just going to squish back and forth right across that valve. Okay, and that's really a bad thing because that's going to cause thrombuses, that's going to cause blood clots in these vein vessels, which eventually might return to your circulatory system and cause a heart attack or stroke or pulmonary embolism or something like that. Okay, so the skeletal muscle pump is one way, but there's another pump, and that is due to your thorax. Okay, so you know that air flows in, air flows out. We haven't talked about why that is, but it's due to pressure changes, right? Because we talked about pressure changes. Air is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. And the way we get air in our lungs is by doing what compared to atmospheric pressure? What do we do to the pressure inside our thoracic cavity compared to atmospheric pressure to get air to flow in? It's got to go below atmospheric pressure. And the way that happens is that we use muscles to increase the volume of the thorax. When the volume increases, the pressure decreases. We'll look at that law when we get to respiratory chapter. All right, so we have low pressure. When muscles contract, primarily what muscle? The diaphragm, right? That increases the volume of your thorax, decreasing its pressure. Air is going to flow into your lungs, which is in your thoracic cavity. All right, what other organ do you know that's in your thoracic cavity? Your heart is right there too, right? So when your chest acts like a vacuum cleaner, sucking air in because the volume expands, guess what? All the blood vessels feel that same negative pressure, so it's actually sucking blood back up to your heart as well. Right, so not only does your thoracic cavity act like a vacuum cleaner for air, but it does for blood as well. We call that the respiratory pump, so that's also very important. Okay, but the reason why that system works is because of these valves, these modifications of these veins. All right, that's it for this chapter. Who came to class with some questions on this chapter? Okay. Doesn't look like I see any questions. Oh, hi. Aham. Okay. Yes. Okay, arteries are the highest pressure. So remember, a fluid like blood will flow from high pressure to low. That's the only way it can flow. So in order for blood to flow from an artery to a capillary, that means that the pressure in an artery has to be higher than a capillary to get that blood flow going in that direction. If pressure was higher in a capillary than an artery, then blood would flow out of a capillary into an artery. And we know that does not happen. Okay. So, and in the next chapter, we're going to actually look at where these pressure changes are and plot them out versus location compared to various blood vessels.
Dr. Goldberg?
Yeah.
When it says that the pressure in the chest during the breathing, is that the inspiration or respiration?
Yeah, pressure drops in the chest during breathing. Okay, during inspiration, yeah. When the diaphragm contracts, volume of the thorax increases. That decreases the pressure. And when the pressure is decreased in your thoracic cavity, then air is going to flow in. Yeah, and that's also going to suck blood up to your heart when that happens. Okay, when you exhale, the volume of your chest decreases, increasing the pressure of the air in your lungs compared to atmospheric pressure, so air is going to flow out. At the same time, that's going to push blood back down to the periphery, but can it? No, because of these valves right here. Okay, so the respiratory pump works because of these valves. The skeletal muscle pump works because of these valves in veins. Okay, so good idea to always maintain these valves in good shape. Doesn't happen for everybody. Okay, so let's preview our next chapter. Okay. Let's see. I want to go to... Let's go to... Blackboard. I guess I don't log into it on this computer very much. Okay. Okay, close your eyes. Close your eyes anyway. Okay, you can open your eyes back up. And what do we want? Oh, here's a physiology one. Nice. Let's see. I can't read the CRN number. Let me pick an active one. I am very popular. Or I'm very populated anyway. Physiology, I think that here's an active. Oh no, sorry, that's anatomy. Sorry. Physiology, here's a physiology one. That's good. Okay, so here is a nice index page, syllabus, course information, course documents. Ooh, it's likely, maybe exam study guide. Let's look at exam study guide first. All right, so I clicked on that. Okay, and I don't see it obvious right in here. Okay. Maybe exam four. Okay, study guide, figure. Cardiac cycle. That's it right there. Okay. Is it true? I better click on it. It is true. Okay, good. All right, so if you can't match these letters up with these numbers, you have to talk with your lab instructor or me, and we got to go over it. Okay, or your SI leader, because he drew this thing. No, I'm kidding. No, I don't want you to be murdered on your way to your car. Okay. Somebody off campus drew this thing out. Okay, so there it is for you to study.
We'll go over it on what's today?
Today's Thursday, so you're going to go over it on Tuesday? Okay, so let's start defining some of these things for the next chapter. So let's go into slideshow mode. We got a couple minutes left, which is nice. If we go over it a little bit, that gives you some orientation for next time. Okay, so cardiac output. Cardiac output is how much blood your heart pumps for some period of time. So that, and cardiac output is a flow. So I think I want to draw on the board, if I can, the difference between velocity and flow. All right, so velocity is the same thing as speed, and that's what you like to measure on your car so you don't get a ticket. And what are the units of speed? That is what? Distance traveled per what? Per time. Like what? Miles per hour. That would be a good dimension for your car. Not so good for your cardiovascular system. You might want to measure it in what? Centimeters per second. Centimeters per second. So that's the dimension for velocity. But now what the heck is flow? Let's put flow down over here. Let's see if I can remember. Flow is equal to, not distance per time, but volume. How much blood, right? How much blood per time is the unit for flow. And what do we like to use in physiology for volume? Milliliters, yeah. So ml per second. That's probably pretty good. Maybe per minute under some circumstances. All right, so do you see that the units are different? So there's a big difference between velocity and flow. And cardiac output is flow. And I'm going to abbreviate that CO. So cardiac output is flow, not velocity. So is the volume of blood pumped each minute? Oh, cardiac output. Let's erase seconds right here and put what? Minute. But that's still a unit of time. Okay, there's another measure of how well the heart is pumping, and we call that stroke volume. Stroke volume means the amount of blood that's pumped out every time the heart beats one time. And you can measure that. And again, that's going to be, instead of minutes right here, stroke volume is going to be volume per beat. How much blood is pumped every time the heart beats. So volume per beat is stroke volume. And to calculate cardiac output, how are we going to get the cardiac output? So stroke volume is equal to what? ML per beat, like this. Another measure for your heart is how fast it's beating. We call that heart rate, right? HR. How do we measure heart rate? Beats per minute. Yeah, beats per minute. All right, so just so happens, if we multiply these two things together, we get cardiac output. And why is that? So let's just draw that down. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. That's going to be milliliters per minute, because stroke volume is what? mLs per beat. Heart rate is beat per minute. So of course these beats cancel out, and what are you left with? Milliliters per minute, which is what we said cardiac output is. All right, so we can measure cardiac output by measuring somebody's stroke volume and heart rate, or for instance, if we know cardiac output in somebody's heart rate, we can calculate stroke volume, any which way that we want to go about doing that. Okay, there are two ways that the heart can be regulated. Oh, this is important. Two ways the heart can be regulated. Due to this equation that you see right here. How can your body adjust cardiac output? It can adjust the rate at which it contracts or the strength at which it contracts. As the strength of the heart increases, the stroke volume gets bigger. Okay? And what happens if both of these things get bigger? The cardiac output gets really big because these things are all directly related to each other. There's nothing in the denominator. Both numbers can change, and we're going to look at the autonomic nervous system, which one of these numbers it affects. Okay, so that's pretty cool when you can see that. All right, so all these things are directly related. Oh, man, there's a weekend. You guys are going to die trying to figure this out. Okay, so you got to come back on Tuesday, and we're going to talk about cardiac output in terms of heart rate and stroke volume. I didn't even plan it that way. Because I wouldn't do it to you.